going out for a walk or a run or whatever, if you're going out and doing something on your own, you're always that thought, that concern is in the back of your mind.
We've been told by police that he was cleaning his car, that he was cleaning his clothes, at which point, of course, my heart sank.
He was very impulsive. This is what we see with impulsive offenders. They typically make mistakes like that because it's not well planned.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Hello and welcome to Best Case, Worst Case. This is Jim Clemente, retired FBI profiler, former New York City prosecutor and writer-producer of CBS's Criminal Minds and Criminal Minds Season 16 on Paramount Plus. And with me today from afar is...
Hi, everybody. Just like you like it, Jim. This is Francie Hakes, former state and federal prosecutor and executive producer and writer of Audible's Midwest Monster. Jim, I'm very happy that we were able to persuade one of our favorite guests to come back because we're right in the middle of profiling a case. And please introduce yourself again, Kathy.
Sure. My name is Kathleen Canning Mello. I'm a retired FBI agent, was in the FBI for 31 years. And many of those years I spent working in the BAU with Jim Clemente. So it's great to be back in your presence once again.
It's great to have you, Kathy. And we'll just have to put up with Francie. But anyway.
Last time we were talking about the horrific case of the kidnapping of young mother Eliza Fletcher, who disappeared Friday, September 2nd, when she was jogging at about 4:30 in the morning. She's a 34-year-old mother of two. Kathy, we've been talking about this case and we got your insights last time. So let's pick right back up where we left off.
Just in terms of the media strategies, we're also, Jim, back in the unit, we also used to assist investigators and prosecutors discussing post-offense behavior, right, on these individuals. So I'm not sure I saw a press release about specifically post-offense behavior, but many of the reports had talked about, just as you had mentioned, him washing his car. I think it was his brother who was interviewed who said that he was washing his car and his clothes.
And his clothes, Kathy. Yeah, both.
So that's, you know, part of the media strategy when you have cases like this is to appeal to people who are close to the subject, right? Who may know these people and say, look, you know, the offender here may have, you know, tried to get rid of his vehicle or clean his vehicle or paint it, or there may be damage to the vehicle that wasn't there previously.
Or he may try to leave the area very quickly for some emergency that just came up, and he won't return till the time when things calm down.
Well, and so, Kathy, once we found out, because this was all, you know, we're still trying to figure out, is Eliza Fletcher alive? And I can't imagine, and my sympathies go out to her family, especially her husband and her children. It's just enraging and so tragically sad. But at this point, we've been told by police that he was cleaning his car, that he was cleaning his clothes, at which point, of course, my heart sinks because now I'm certain that she is no longer alive. Why else would he be trying to clean his car and his clothes if not trying to remove blood or other forensic evidence? So, Kathy, how do police go from there? They told us that the suspect refused to say where Eliza was. So Right. You've got his car, you've got him now, you've got his cell phone, but Eliza's cell phone is smashed and we don't know where she is. So what do the investigators do to try to find her?
So again, you know, here comes the CAS team with their information about the device location that they have of the subject. So they find an area, it was not too far, I think 7 miles.
Yeah, that's right.
Miles from the abduction site, where they can pinpoint, or pretty close to it, where the offender was in this area. So, of course, the investigator search teams are going and looking at that area to try to find this victim.
And there that's a lot of manpower, isn't it, Kathy? I mean, it's not like they can pinpoint, you know, where the body is just because his cell phone was in the area. I mean, they still have to put people on the ground physically hunting with their eyes.
And that these cases are so manpower intensive because you have search teams there. There's so many things that are going on in a short amount of time because everybody's working 24/7 trying to find this victim. But there was apparently a report of some odor that was emanating from a property not far from where the cell phone tower had, you know, pinged where the subject's phone was. And so the investigators were focusing in on that area where this odor was emanating, and they ended up finding her behind an abandoned property, I believe it was.
It's so senseless. It's so tragic. It makes you so angry. You know, she's an innocent young mother of two, her whole life ahead of her, her kids, you know, need her, her husband and family and friends are now all robbed of having her in their lives. And one of the things I want to talk about, motive now. So we talked a little bit, Jim, about, you know, you and Kathy both thought it was likely this was probably a sexually motivated crime of opportunity, given all the things that we've talked about. One of the, I guess, saddest, most horrifying things to me, especially again, Kathy, as a woman, was that news reported that her purple jogging shorts were found in like a trash bag somewhere not that far from her body, which of course means they weren't on her. And I don't know what it is. I had a case once about, you know, something else. It was a sex offender and his shoes. And it was something about almost like the banality of the article of clothing and the horrific nature of the crime that combined to make me feel just so sick. Like, it's already a horrific crime, but something about the ultimate indignity that, you know, now for literally forever, her body is going to be captured in crime scene photos without her running shorts on. And I just, as a woman, it makes me feel so sick and emotional because, of course, we all know what that means. And I just think, just one last horror in what had to be a horror-filled last few minutes of her life. If I could, I mean, I know Jim and I disagree on this. You and I probably do too, Kathy. But if I could pull the lever on the, you know, electric chair for this man, I would. And I would sleep like a baby after.
Yeah,
I mean, I'm serious about that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and this is Tennessee, right? So this is a death penalty state.
It is a death penalty state.
Likely will be facing a death penalty. But I agree with you. Just as we started off this segment saying, like, we can identify as women just going out for a walk or a run or whatever. If you're going out and doing something on your own, you're always that thought, that concern is in the back of your mind that men typically don't have to deal with. So here we have, you know, the discovery of these shorts, which, you know, seems to indicate that this was a sexually motivated crime. But as investigators, the good news, if a horrible case, but the good news is, you know, this individual is not very criminally sophisticated, right? I mean, he's dumping the body, he's dumping her shorts. There's a lot of physical evidence that can be recovered from the crime scene, from the shorts, from her body. Thank God they found her body, because it's much more difficult to, as you know, as a prosecutor, to successfully prosecute a no-body homicide. So, and, you know, ultimately for the victim's family, at least they'll be able to memorialize her, to have a service for her and you know, be able to visit her grave, wherever that is. That is comfort, as small measure as it is in these types of cases, that they'll be able to bury her.
Right. And the thing about it is that when you say, you know, this guy wasn't really forensically sophisticated, obviously there was a, you know, an actual recording of the abduction, right? Mm-hmm. So clearly he didn't know what he was doing, when he was doing it. He was very impulsive. This is what we see with impulsive offenders. They typically make mistakes like that because it's not well planned. But even so, sometimes they get lucky and there is no witness, there's no clue. Clearly, the fact that he had, you know, basically flip-flops on and which were not really a good set of shoes to be wearing when you're going to abduct someone. So that, you know, then led to the DNA identification of him. And it also confirmed the sighting that you know, that this guy forced her into the van, and then confirmed that this is a guy with a history of abduction.
Physical violence, yeah.
Right.
Well, Jim, I wanted to ask you about that, actually. So he does have this history. He has a prior conviction for abduction that was a robbery motive. This is, I mean, I suppose there could be a combination motive here. He could have intended to rob her and sexually assault her. I don't know. We don't know. Maybe we'll find that out. But what I want to know from you, Jim, is what I think people will wonder is he has that one thing in his criminal history, a prior kidnapping of a man for a robbery motive. So there's no sexual assault in his history. There was some indication from people near where he lived that he was, I mean, people called him a pervert. People said he was catcalled women, made them uncomfortable. But there's no, as far as I'm aware, there's no actual conviction for a prior sexual assault.
Well, you know, Francie, that the conviction rate for sexual assault is less than
1%. That's why I'm asking you that, James. Right.
Yeah, so, you know, to expect that, and it doesn't mean he hasn't done it many times before. Yeah. It just means that he's never been caught and convicted of it before.
Do you think it is likely, and I'd like to ask Kathy this question too, but you first, Jim, do you think it's likely that this was his first sexual offense? I mean, this seems to me like, I'm not taking it lightly, but like a graduate level offense.
Well, if he has a reputation for being a creep around his neighborhood, you know, I'd say no, this isn't his first offense. This is something that, you know, he may have been thinking about for a long time, likely fantasizing about for a long time, not necessarily specifically fixated on this victim, but on some victim. And she happened to fall into his net. That's it, you know, and it's very unfortunate for her. It's terrible for her that she went through this. And yeah, it's horrible for her family as well. But this is why when people know somebody who's a creep, they should actually make a record of it. They should call the police no matter what. You know, if he sexualizes children or makes women feel uncomfortable, then that's a good reason to call the police. That's a good reason to get some kind of record of the fact that he is harassing people, that he has sexual motives. Let's build a fence around this guy. Let everybody who has heard and seen him do something bad, everybody call the police. And so there are records that will help the police focus on somebody like him and hopefully get him off the street earlier.
Yeah, I wonder if we're going to see other women come forward, Kathy, that he might have victimized in the past. But what do you think? I mean, I'm not a profiler like you guys, but I can't see this being his first sexual offense. That doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah, I agree. This was such a brazen attack. It certainly indicates this person is somebody who is physically violent and likely has a past of physical violent behavior against women. But also I wanted to mention as well, apparently he was facing recent charges for a theft of a debit card, a female's debit card. And I haven't heard a subsequent report about how it was taken from her, but she recognized that her debit card was used at a gas station. So he's facing recent charges. So going back to the media strategies, that's another aspect of behavior that we often see in these individuals. There's some kind of a recent stressor going on in the individual's life that may have peaked around this time, that may have influenced that individual's aggressive behavior, in this case, a horrible violent crime. But that's a behavior that we often see in these types of crimes, is this stressor, the situational stressor that's going on around that time.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
Well, what drives me the most crazy is I hear, well, there's a lot of things that drive me crazy, as Jim knows, but one of the things that's disturbing about this case is you will hear experts talk about, like we've done a little bit, talking about prevention and how to keep yourself safe. And I mean, I know this is sort of unrealistic, but why can't a young mother of two go running at 4:30 in the morning in a major city in this country perfectly safely? Ought to be able to do it. All ought to be able to do it.
But because
how many women today
there.
Now won't do it? You know what I mean? Like how many women are not going to do it because they're now going to be afraid that someone like this offender is out there and can target them. And it just illustrates again how Kathy, you said before, how vulnerable we feel as women. I mean, because we are smaller generally, weaker generally than a lot of men. And so we might fight for our life, but we're probably going to lose. And so
there's a reason why there are, self-defense classes. There are things you can carry with you. I always carry a tactical pen, which is a pen that's also acts as it can break the glass of a car window if you get stuck in water, and you need to get out, or if there's a fire and you need to get out. But it's also a good tool to inflict pain on somebody who's grabbed you. And that's just a little thing that you can have with you. There are, all sorts of personal safety weapons and mechanisms that if you're doing something and you're going to be alone, it definitely pays. It makes sense to have some sort of protection with you. The cell phone is just not enough because it takes seconds to make a call and that can be interrupted and you never get any help. So, you really have to, everybody has to think this way. It's sad that they have to think this way, but it is something that really is a necessity in a world in which we have people like this freely roaming the streets, who have committed crimes like this, who have creeped out their neighbors and eventually act on it in a way that takes a wonderful person's life.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Kathy, any other thoughts about this particular case? My final sort of thought is, before I go to you for the final thought of the podcast, is just that, the investigator's job isn't really done today. They're going to be putting together a case for prosecution so that they can seek whatever penalty the prosecutor decides to seek in this case. I hope they can seek the death penalty. I'm for it. Mm-hmm. But they have to put together an airtight case. And so all that data that you mentioned, the cell phone data and all the traffic cameras and all the search teams and the forensic evidence, all of that is going to still be going on for the next several weeks so that they can put together an investigative package for the prosecutor so that they can keep this dangerous offender behind bars forever, or maybe, you know, getting the death penalty ultimately. So what are your final thoughts on the case?
Right. Like you said, it's going to be probably several months before they can, you know, solidify all of the important aspects and develop and process all of the physical evidence that still remains, right? Of course, they have DNA, but they want to process the vehicle. They're going to process the shorts in order to get more DNA. There's still a lot of work to be done by the investigators and prosecutors to make an airtight case against this individual. And who knows, I saw a recent public release by the defense attorneys, and they don't know right now whether they're going to go towards a death penalty, but my expectation is there probably will be. But it just illustrates this case, and Jim and I have worked so many, just how dedicated these law enforcement officers are, right? I mean, this was a 24/7 case from the very beginning, where you had all kinds of elements together, people working on the victimology, people working on the physical and the scientific evidence, people working on the CAST team. And if I just can give a special shout out to the CAST team, because they have a near and dear spot in my heart. I was working with Bill Shute, who was an investigator with the FBI in Philadelphia way back in the early 2000s. And it was his sort of invention to have these teams throughout the Bureau to be able to analyze cell phone data. So it's going back, you know, nearly 20 years right now. Mm-hmm. But they have been so instrumental in these types of cases, finding the remains of children and adult victims over the years. You know, it's probably hundreds, if not thousands by this point, not only in the United States, but they also help foreign investigators too. But just such a benefit to law enforcement and the criminal justice system to have these dedicated folks who are so, you know, just so motivated and focused on developing this very important data in order to help investigators, to help prosecutors, to help victims, families, for loved ones to be able to be reconnected with their loved one in these types of tragedies. Really, really important stuff.
Well, that's a great point, Kathy. I mean, there are so many cops and FBI agents and analysts and prosecutors who care deeply about Eliza Fletcher. They never met her. They never will. They care deeply about Eliza Fletcher and seeing that justice is done for her and her family.
Yeah. And Kathy, if you remember in the Jada Justice case, that cell phone data became incredibly critically important in terms of locating her body and in terms of flipping one of the offenders, and also in terms of locating her body. And you know, today, obviously, technology has increased. There are, you know, a tremendous number of benefits associated with the fact that people are so attached to their phones. Of course, there's also some very negative things attached to it, because everybody who has a phone, and many of them are kids, is now vulnerable also to, it gives offenders access to kids and people who are vulnerable. So it's a double-edged sword, but I'm glad that in this case it helped to resolve, you know, a very, very horrific case. Mm-hmm. And hopefully it will also go a long way in terms of proving the case against them.
Mm-hmm. So, Kathy, we've talked about the investigators and what they're going to be doing with respect to putting together a case for prosecution. Can you talk to us, because most of us have never been quite in the position like you and Jim have, of having to transition. So first, it's search mode, but then it's case mode. You know, what is the difference? Search mode, you find the victim. Now it's case mode. How do you transition to that in your head from what must be an adrenaline pumping sort of, we've got to find her, we've got to find her, to, oh, now we find her, it's methodical. How do you make that transition?
Well, the two obviously are not mutually exclusive. So while you're doing the search, you're also thinking about the prosecution, right? So you want to make sure your searches are organized, that they're very well documented. And in this case, right, you have search teams at the abduction site once you've identified that. So thank God we have this video. We're able to identify the abduction site. We have community members that find the telephone. They find the slides. So you have a lot of stuff going on with the search teams at that abduction site. And then once you identify, in this case, we had the good fortune of identifying where the body was located. So you're going to have search teams at that location. All kinds of work is going to be done in her body recovery and trying to find more evidence around that scene where she was sexually assaulted. There may have been actually another scene where she was sexually assaulted, may have occurred in the vehicle or may have occurred somewhere else where we haven't even identified it yet, right? And that was the body disposal scene where they ended up finding her. So there's a lot of work going at that site. There's a bunch of work going on where they found that trash bag where her gym shorts were found. That's another search team that's found and when working on that site. So all of that is working together. And while you're having these teams and they're reporting back, you're also thinking about, all right, how is this always all going to come together? What other interviews need to be done in order to shore up, to try to figure out what other searches that need to be done? What other community, maybe neighborhood investigations that need to be done, right? Because we need to find whether there may have been some other CCTV in the area of where that trash bag was disposed of or where her body was disposed of. So there's a lot of other investigation and thinking about other people to interview in order to corroborate and provide good substance to prosecute this individual. And you're dealing with prosecutors as well during this phase.
That's such a great point, Kathy. And what it brings to my mind is motive. You know, we've talked about that on this podcast a gazillion times, motive. And as I've said before, you don't have to prove motive. Motive is not part of the element of any crime, but prosecutors need it. We need it. I feel like I always needed it. I always want it because you want to give that motive to the jury so that you're just solid on exactly what happened and exactly why it happened. And so I think that community canvas, Jim, I mean, don't you think that investigators right now are going to want to talk to people who know the offender? Just because they have him in custody doesn't mean they're finished learning about him.
No, right? And that's what I was saying. I mean, if he had that reputation for being a creep, then there are stories out there. There are plenty of stories out there. He didn't earn that reputation from doing nothing. And so all those things are going to be they're going to be critical in terms of building a picture of who this person really is. And what kind of other things he might have done. There may be other crimes out there that he has committed that the victims will now come forward about because he's in custody, because they may have been afraid to do anything before. And I would encourage everyone who has had a negative contact or is aware of a negative contact with this guy to actually come forward and talk to the police and actually give them more ammunition to basically build a case against this guy.
Well, and the prosecution too, Jim. I mean, certainly in Georgia, lots of states and federal court, they have what's called similar transaction evidence. And so if he has behaved in any similar way in the past, that evidence may be useful in helping prove the case, prove that he, in fact, is the person who assaulted and murdered Eliza
Fletcher. If he's sexually harassing people, is that similar transaction evidence in your mind?
Maybe. I think it depends. It depends on what happened during the confrontation with him and Eliza Fletcher. And I would think also to you two investigators, former FBI agents, they're going to want to see if there's ever been a path cross before between this offender and Eliza Fletcher. Oh, because what if he did exactly that, Jim? What if he stalked her? What if he's catcalled her? And if that's similar to behavior that he's engaged in with some other woman, it could be similar. It could establish a pattern, and pattern evidence is admissible in these kinds of cases.
Right. But what I'm saying is, just if this is a sexually motivated crime, then any sexual advances or harassment that he's committed before, even if it hadn't risen to the level of sexual assault, that to me would be important information for the jury to consider. And I hope that they're able to find more of that information and it all helps build a more detailed picture about this guy and his past.
Well, and thank you, Kathy, for joining us. And you said it so well, but thank you to all the law enforcement officers and agents and analysts and soon to be prosecutors who'll be working on this case and who work on cases just like this, who don't get this kind of publicity to their cases, to the victims who don't get this kind of publicity. So our hearts go out to all of you. Thank you for all the work that you're doing for victims, famous and not famous, all around the country.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much for inviting me. I really enjoyed it.
All right, great. Well, it's always great to see you, Kathy, and have you tell us about cases and also give us your analysis on cases. Well, till next time, thank you to all our listeners and viewers for tuning in. This is Best Case, Worst Case, signing off.
Best Case, Worst Case is an XG production produced by Francie Hakes, Josh Murphy, and Jim Clementi at Empire Studios, LA. Engineered and edited by Matt Gergel. Music composed and performed by Simba Tsumba and hosted by Wondery.
You can listen to Best Case, Worst Case on your favorite listening app. We are on Spotify, Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, and wherever you listen to podcasts.
If you want to do something about child sexual abuse, Darkness Delight can help. Did you know that more than 90% of the time children are sexually abused by someone they know?
Jim, this isn't about stranger danger. It's about learning the true risks. Darkness to Light's training can help prevent, recognize, and react to child sexual abuse in your community.
When you make the decision to get involved, kids can be protected. It starts with you.
Visit www.d2l.org to take the training and learn more.
That's D2L.org.